Stephen Johnson's the author of such bestsellers as The Invention of Air, The Ghost Map, and Mind Wide Open. His new book is called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. Johnson opens the book with a description of Charles Darwin's 1836 visit to the coral reef off the Keeling Islands. Coral reefs recur throughout the book. Stephen Johnson explains the connection he sees between the coral reef and innovation.
The thing that is so interesting about the coral reef is that it is capable of creating all this amazing kind of biodiversity. I mean, it accounts for this extraordinary amount of something like 25% of the species of marine life are in coral reefs, even though they're a small fraction of 1% of the surface of the planet. So they themselves, in biological terms, are great innovators, right? They create a space where all these different kind of livelihoods can be pursued by all these different organisms. And there's a kind of a riddle there, which is, the waters of the coral reef are actually kind of nutrient poor. They shouldn't support that much life. And yet somehow there's this great thriving metropolis under the sea there. The kind of mystery there is known as Darwin's paradox, that, you know, you would see so much biodiversity in such a kind of unlikely place. And so in this book, I wanted to kind of look not just at spaces where human beings have been unusually innovative, but I also wanted to look at spaces where kind of life has been unusually innovative. And so the coral reef kind of becomes the motif for that.
This is where the adjacent possible comes in, right? You've identified seven, I think, key patterns behind genuine innovation. And the first of them is the adjacent possible. Can you explain that for us?
In a sense, it's the framing pattern that explains in general what the other patterns are doing. It's a wonderful term from the scientist Stuart Kaufman that I first read about 10 years ago, and it's one of those ideas I've been trying to get into a book ever since I first read it. And Stuart's idea basically is that there is, at any given point in a moment in history, in a moment in kind of the evolution of life, there's the given kind of state of the system, whether it's a technology platform or a coral reef. And there are a certain number of transformations that are possible. There are certain ways in which that state can be changed. And then there's a certain huge number of ways in which it can't be changed. And it's like, imagine a chessboard. You're at a certain point in the middle of the game. There's a finite number of moves that you can make. There are a lot of them, but there's a finite number. The adjacent possible is all those potential moves that are available to you. So, you know, if you think about it this way, you can't, for instance, in the history of technology, you can't invent a microwave oven in 1600. It just is, it exceeds the bounds of the adjacent possible. And so when you're trying to think kind of an innovative way, whether it's in your organization or your personal life or, you know, in society, what you're trying to do is explore the edges of the adjacent possible, not jump too far ahead, not exceed those boundaries, but kind of knock on the doors at the edges of that space and find the new things that you're capable of changing.
You can't talk about ideas these days without talking about copyright and intellectual property. How do we find the balance between allowing a free flow of ideas that's going to lead to other great ideas and compensating the people who developed the original ideas?
Well, the word you used is the right one, balance. I'm not a kind of a free culture extremist here. I think that there is a place for intellectual property law and for copyright and patents. And indeed, one of the reasons patents were developed was that they involved an element of disclosure. You had to file your patent and expose to the rest of the world. You just were protected for a period of time, but you also had to share the idea. In a sense, this is a book that is trying to argue that the primary driver of innovation is not just the profit motive, not just the competitive pressure of kind of proprietary firms. It's not just the marketplace, but that there is a long and very rich history of world-changing ideas that came out of more open, more connective environments, whether it's kind of the Enlightenment scientists who were just doing it for the love of it, or the university system, or the open source environments, the internet and the web. And that tradition is just as powerful and maybe even more powerful than the kind of competitive marketplace. And so, in a sense, the slogan for that is that, you know, it's important for ideas to connect as it is for us to try and protect them, in a sense. So what's the balance? And I'll just tell you one example. There's a wonderful program by Nike. Nike has a corporate mission to be more environmentally sustainable in what it does. It's a big part of their overarching goals as an organization. They realize that they're sitting on all this interesting intellectual property, some of which is patented, in their research and development labs. You know, new rubbers for their sneakers that will be more environmentally sustainable to build, right? Now, they realize that by holding this stuff secret, they have ideas there that might actually be useful to somebody in a field that's not at all competitive to what Nike does, right? There's a tire manufacturer who could use those rubbers. Nike doesn't make tires. And so they created this thing called the Green Exchange in concert with Creative Commons, and they released all these ideas with a new kind of patent. And the patent basically says, you know, here's an easy little one-click form to take our ideas. You don't need to negotiate a contract to borrow this stuff. And the only thing is, don't use it in a field that's competitive with stuff that we do.
So don't make shoes.
Yeah, if you're making sneakers, if you're Adidas, you can't use it. But if you are of Goodyear and you're making a tire, that's fine. And there are ideas that not only will that make for, you know, help their cause of a more sustainable future, but they might learn from somebody else's appropriation of their ideas, and somebody might add something to it, and they can borrow it back. And that's a kind of balance where it's using patents, it's using intellectual property law, but it's respecting the need of these ideas to make these unlikely connections.
Another of the seven key patterns you describe in the book is serendipity. Now, serendipity sounds like an accident to me, but maybe that's a good idea. Maybe we need accidents.
Yeah, you want to have a certain level of noise in the data, right? You want to have a little bit of kind of surprising connections. I mean, for instance, one thing I talk about in the book is that I use this interesting kind of research tool, which is a piece of software called DevonThink, when I'm working on my books. And I've put into DevonThink over the years thousands of little quotes from books that I've read and articles that I've read that I found interesting.
A digital commonplace book.
Yeah, exactly. Commonplace book being the kind of old Enlightenment era kind of tradition. And DevonThink has this kind of special software trick where it can detect kind of subtle, semantic, kind of meaningful connections between small snippets of text. And so I'll write a paragraph, and then I don't do this all the time, but when I'm kind of in an improvisational mode with my ideas, I'll write a paragraph and I'll show it to DevonThink and say, show me things that are related to this. And it'll come back with all these quotes, some of them that I read, you know, 10 years ago that I've completely forgotten. I mean, I've forgotten the book that the quote is from, much less the quote. And it's noisy. It's not always right. You know, the first three are really obvious connections. The next four are really random and not at all right. But the next one, there's something brilliant there. And it's precisely because it's a little bit noisy, a little bit chaotic, that it ends up taking me down these interesting new avenues. And I've had connections suggested to me through DevonThink that have led to entire chapters of books. And the question really, and it sounds like a joke, but it's a serious question, is when those, you know, big ideas come out of that interaction, who's really having the idea? You know, is it me or is it the software, right? And I think on some level you have to say it's a little bit of both. It's a kind of duet between two very different kinds of intelligence.
Well, it is a lot like the commonplace book used to be, except that it adds that ability to remember things that's hard for humans.
Yeah. I mean, what's important about the commonplace book tradition, and I think this is something we can still do, you know, people like Jefferson and Franklin and Locke, they would keep these books where they would write down all these quotes. But a big thing that they would do is they would go back and they would reread their commonplace book. And in a sense, their intellectual kind of sense of self, their perspectives on the world, would come out of revisiting all these quotes that they'd taken from other sources and some of their own notes in between them. And it was by remixing all these different ideas and synthesizing them and revisiting them that slowly over time they would kind of forge their own identity and their own ideas. And that's something we can still do. You don't even need a very complex semantic search algorithm to do that. You can just write down your notes and quote things and just revisit those ideas.
Tell me about fourth quadrant systems. We're in the fourth quarter of the game here. Is that what you're thinking about? Fourth quadrant systems?
Well, the problem with writing a book where you're making an argument about how culture works is that the easiest way to do it, although it's not terribly easy, but what I do for most of the book is there's just a lot of stories or a lot of anecdotes, you know, 30, 40, 50 different stories from different fields. And you try and convince people that the point you're making is true and that these anecdotes represent the truth about society. But people are always going to accuse you of kind of cherry-picking and not telling these other stories that make the other point. And so in the last chapter, to kind of combat or anticipate that criticism, I kind of zoomed out and looked at 300, you know, big innovations in science and in technology over that last 600 years and just tried to figure out how many of them came from kind of individual entrepreneurs working with the profit motive, how many came from corporations kind of competing with each other, how many of them came from just amateur individuals, and how many of them came from kind of networked open source environments or university environments where there's a lot of collaboration and sharing of ideas and so on. And that's the fourth quadrant. And I kind of map them onto this grid. And the fourth quadrant is that open space. And it turns out, even in the modern age, even after the development of kind of modern industrial and consumer capitalism, while the marketplace does generate a lot of important things, and there's a great explosion in activity there, the fourth quadrant is even bigger. There's more innovation that comes out of that space. And it's precisely because the connective power of that environment, the freedom of ideas to kind of move and be refined and be accepted, is stronger than the kind of incentivizing, you know, force of financial reward. Mm. And so it's hopefully making the argument not that those two, oftentimes what you find is that the fourth quadrant creates a platform that commercial, you know, entities can then build upon. I mean, think about the web. Think about how many immense fortunes have been made on top of this very open platform. So they're not at odds with each other. They actually can collaborate in lots of ways as well.
So you actually ask the question whether it's possible to harness that. It's a more involved question, the way you put it. But that's interesting. And what leads me to wonder whether, in fact, if you can harvest the fourth quadrant systems, does another quadrant develop? Because you have to have one that's outside of your harness.
Mm, that's really interesting. Yeah, it's possible that we've created these new ways of collaborating, that there are these new models, whether it's the web or Wikipedia, that are going to become the new normal. And someone is going to figure out this, you know, this extra space out there that can, you know, how do you innovate on top of an open innovative platform like Wikipedia? But those people, I think, are smarter than I am. So I don't have that in my head.
Yet, even but, after all of this, clearly you've thought a lot about this. And I'm assuming this has changed the way you approach your work.
Well, the fun thing is that the book itself is an example of the kind of thinking that I'm arguing for. I mean, it is a very connective book, and my methods in putting these stories together, and in a sense trying to, in reading it, hopefully the reader gets to go through all these different fields and stories, and, you know, from biology to technology, from the very old technology to the very recent. And through all those jumps, you know, there will be interesting collisions and surprising connections, and there certainly were for me when I was writing it.
Stephen Johnson's the author of Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation.